exactly the same interferometer that we had before. We'll have our neutron beam coming in. And up until now, we've treated the neutron beam as though the neutrons each had exactly the same momentum. And so if they have exactly the same momentum, then you know that we would describe them as a plane wave. And the plane wave, of course, has infinite spatial extent. And so there's nothing interesting that we are going to associate with that plane wave. And now what we're going to do is recognize that there's some spread in momentum in this neutron beam. And I'm going to focus, because it's experimentally the most useful direction, I'm going to focus on the spread of momentum along the z direction. And you can see that the z direction, remember that the blades of the crystal planes of the interferometer are in this direction. So the crystal is actually quite accepting of a spread of momentum in the z direction. And it is incredibly unaccepting, of course, of spreads in momentum in other directions. So here we'll have a parameter that we can introduce a spread and explore what happens with that spread. Okay? And conceptually, what we'll do is we'll introduce a spread of momentum. So we have delta kz here. And then we'll ask what happens if I displace the neutron beam in one of these paths. So you imagine that the neutron beam in one of the paths is going through as we like. And in the other path, we'll picture it as coming towards us. Okay, since we have this top-down view. And then we ask, when we look at these two, so if we look at it from the side, you know, we'll have this first neutron beam, and the second neutron beam, well, I guess this is this one, and that is that one. You know, it's a horrible way to think about it. Don't let's not get caught up in this, right? But there's a separation here. We're going to introduce a separation, delta z. Yes. Yes. So that we'll shift them relative to each other, and we'll ask what is the interference effects. And of course, you know, if we think about the size of a neutron, right? The size of the neutron is completely irrelevant here, right? You know, it says, oh, geez, we need to be right to a femtometer. You know, no way are we ever right to a femtometer, and who bloody well cares, anyways. What we need to have overlap is we need the wave packets to overlap. Okay. And the wave packets, because delta kz is reasonably small, okay, then the wave packets are reasonably broad in momentum space, in real space, sorry. And so they'll overlap, and we'll see this. Now what, you know, just thinking out loud for a second, what happens if they don't overlap? You know, what happens if I've moved these two by a centimeter, but the width of the wave packet is only a millimeter? Somebody? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Okay, I like it. You say that there's no interference. Good. So yes, if you separate them, there's no interference, and so then the probability that the neutron would hit one of these two detectors is it's both 50%. There's nothing interesting that's going to come out of this. Okay, so we're going to have a very nice detection of what happened with the neutron beam. All we need to ask is, hey, do we see contrast? If we saw a contrast, then we know that at least part of those wave packets actually overlapped. Okay. So, just a quick reminder. It's almost embarrassing, but let's put it down. If we just write down the Schrodinger's equation, you know, that's... and here, I'm just looking at the wave number of the neutrons. I don't care about this. Of course, we can vary the wave number by introducing a potential. We saw that already. We introduced a potential. It was a magnetic potential, right? And that gave us a nice separation between two magnetic states. And when we created that magnetic potential, right? And so I shifted the let's redraw that. When I had this experiment, I put the magnetic field here. And we slowed down the neutrons in that path, right? Oh, I'm sure I do. Yeah. When I slowed down the neutrons, then I could also describe this in terms of a wave packet, right? That now we have the neutrons coming in along the path. We're thinking about the momentum along the path of the neutrons. Okay, we apply this change in potential. We're going to slow down or speed up the neutrons because, of course, it's the same potential, but it has a different sign. Okay, and then we can say, oh, well, they arrive at a different time. And we could look at the interference there of these wave packets. But, of course, since the interferometer is incredibly selective of momentum, what we would find is that even though you've spread those out, everything still overlaps really nicely, right? Because the wave packet is really broad in time in this case, right? And so we still see a phase shift. And what did we see? We saw that there was always a phase shift. And that's also true experimentally, though I didn't show you the data. There's always a phase shift here. We can't, you know, regardless of what value of field we put here, the momentum selection is so precise that the wave packet extends so far out in time that we're not able to shift the beam outside of the coherence length of the momentum and the velocity direction. Okay? Here, it's quite different, because now, since z doesn't, the Bragg condition doesn't depend upon the momentum in the z direction, we have much bigger changes in momentum that are allowed to us. Yeah? Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to, just as you would in conventional optics, we're going to introduce an index of refraction, the index of refraction of the neutron. That is the ratio of the wave number under the potential. So this is a wave number under some potential, and of course the wave number in free space. And since we write it in terms of wave numbers, we could rewrite it in terms of velocities, if you prefer that. But it's just nothing interesting there. It's just to say that we have an index of refraction. And the index of refraction I gave you in the first lecture notes, a table of potentials. And one of those was the coherent scattering potential. And the coherent scattering potential leads to an index of refraction And let me get this correct, because otherwise I won't. No.
Just 2 pi.
So B sub C, it's the wavelength, of course. B sub C is the coherent scattering cross section, and B is just the, you write it as N. It's just the number density. Okay, so it just tells us, this tells us what the coherent scattering cross section is per atom. This just says how many atoms you interact with. Okay. And of course, it depends upon a velocity. And this thing is about, this piece here is about 10 to the minus 5. So it's a very small change in index of refraction. But that's OK. Things are moving slowly. A small change is easy to see. So we're going to take our two prisms again. Then I'm going to arrange them in this geometry. So I'll have a neutron beam that comes in, and without the prisms, of course, it would go there. Pretend I can draw a straight line. And so we'll introduce a separation here of delta z. And the extent of that separation will depend upon the separation of the two prisms. Okay? And given that we have a path length of about 10 centimeters here in the particular interferometer that we're talking about, this separation delta Z for silica crystals is about up to, well, it's 0 to about 0.1 microns. There are other experiments where we can go a little bit further, but we have this separation. Okay. Now, we have an interference effect here. And so what are we going to see? We're going to see a phase coming out of this that depends upon KZZ. So we still have a phase shifter here. I still need to put the normal phase flag so that we can, you know, we need this just so that we can rotate it and see if there is, in fact, contrast, right? Otherwise, we get an intensity, but we don't get a contrast curve. And so we say that we have an output state that depends upon the probability of KZ. I'm not going to have enough space. Let me write it like this. So this is the wave function that we have coming in at this point. This is the input of that particular beam. It tells us what is the wave function for some particular choice of z1 and z2. And of course, what we're going to see is that when we go through this third blade, we have an interference effect. And the interference is going to give us the separation between z1 and z2. So we say, oh, yeah, this is that Z0 and Z1, as I wrote it. Z1, 0, Z1. And so we get an interference effect, which will have a term that looks like e to the I kz delta z, okay, integrated over the probability that we have a certain value of kz. Okay. In delta z, well, this is fixed for us, right? It's fixed by this, by the prism. We don't need to integrate over that. Okay. And, you know, we're saying that, that of course, here we need to integrate over the whole beam height. But remember, the beam height is boring. It just says that, that over some range of a centimeter, we have neutrons. They all have the same average momentum. And beyond that, nothing interesting happens. So let's have a look. So if I now take the neutron interferometry setup, I need to show you that, that we have here the guide hall. So here, this is the neutron guide. We have a raptor over here. We have our first crystal to select out a particular momentum. Then we have another crystal to select out a momentum. And then we have, I'll do it this way, a focusing monochromator. That is made up of 9 crystals. And each of these crystals is going to direct the same energy onto the front blade of our 3-blade interferometer. And this plane that, that they're focusing in, that is the z direction for our process. The reason we do this, of course, is that we would like to have some intensity. So we want to make sure that we can get as many neutrons onto the interferometer as possible. And let me draw it in the other orientation. It makes it a little bit clearer, right? They're focusing in that way. And because the z momentum isn't so important, we have that right to add some results. Okay. So then, the all right. So this is the same experimental setup. We have the last monochromator. It's called the second one here because we don't count the first one that's in the beam break. So yeah?
The crystals select out a neutron with a particular wave number, right? And does it, I mean, in the end, does it try to select out more, like, in the X, the KZ that it's trying to select out? Or?
Okay, thank you. So this monochromator is basically just going to select out those neutrons that have a velocity that is about 2,000 meters per second. And, you know, it's plus and minus a few percent. Okay, so it's a, in this case, it's a pyrolytic graphite crystal. So there's intentional defects in the graphite. You know what pyrolytic? You know graphite that you have these planes, and the distance between the planes is actually some subject to control. We can move that, and so it's a nice crystal for monochrometry because you can say, hey, I can sort of tune the crystal to what I want. And then I can cross-link between the crystal blades and lock it into some piece that is of use to us. So with pyrolytic graphite, here we have a rough selection only of the velocity. So at this point, you know, the neutrons are going down the guide hole. There's nickel on the surface. These things are big. And the way guide holes work is if the neutrons have a very grazing angle, then they'll be directed back into the guide. Okay, so the only momentum of neutrons that make it through the guide are those really that are traveling along the guide direction. Okay, so there's a little opening here, it comes out. This monochromator is now a good single crystal. It selects much higher precision. And here we start to select in the particular direction that the so now then I've got the neutrons coming in. And let's take the directions like this, right? So there's a velocity direction, and then there's this out-of-plane direction. So let's just call it the out-of-plane. And then there's the z direction, which is really not that important, right? So what we need is the velocity to be the right and it to be in the right direction, right? So this arrangement says, yes, we really do get it in the right direction. This piece here just says that I can spread it out along Z. Okay, so we have our focusing monochromator. It is some meters away from the interferometer, and I don't know if you can see it, but there's two prisms there that we will move to have a look at this. And as I look at the intensity, in other words, the contrast. Let's see if I have that. If I have that up here. It just says all the same things that we said before. And that's not what I want. I do have it here. Here we go. Thank you. Here's the contrast curves as a function of the separation between the two neutron beams. Okay, so for each of these, what we do is we vary the phase in the neutron interferometer. So I have the neutron interferometer. I set the prisms to some distance. Then I have a phase flag. We vary the phase flag, measure the contrast curve, and report on the contrast. Just not the neutron intensity, but just the amount of contrast that remains. And you can see that if I have just one blade, if I take that focusing monochromator and I remove everything except the central blade, when I remove everything but the central blade, of course, then I only have a very narrow range of momentum in the z direction. When we do that, we get the contrast curve at the top. It says that regardless of what the separation is out to 300 angstroms, there's no loss in contrast. So directly we know the width of the momentum curve. As we add blades into the interferometer, then, of course, the contrast falls down because we've made the spread of momentum larger by having more and more of these in a direction. The signal to noise goes up, but the spread of momentum, in other words, the coherence length of the interferometer, drops down. If we were to quantify coherence length, the coherence length is where we've dropped the contrast by a factor of 2, we can see that we could characterize that here. Yeah?
Is that a sink function
of neutrons? It's not, but thanks for asking the question. It has some of the features of it. But now, to answer your question, we take the Fourier transform of it. Okay, so here I have the sum over a phase. I should show it on the board. Here I have an integral of the probability of kz, e to the I kz delta z d delta z, right? And I'm varying delta z in my experiment, right? And so let's replace that with kaz, and let's call this the contrast as a function of delta z. Now this looks really appealing, right? Because this says that I have a Fourier transform, the momentum spread. And so if I want to know the momentum spread, all I need to do is to take the inverse Fourier transform of the data, right? So what I'll do is to take the inverse Fourier transform of this, and then I'll be able to answer Tieber's question. So if I do that, I will not see what I want because it's up here. So this is the Fourier transform of the contrast curve versus delta z. And you can see that if I have just the one blade, we get a nice Gaussian result. And of course, it has some width. It has some width because of the imperfections of the crystals in a monochromator. But now let me show you here. Pay attention to the width here, right? This is 5/1000ths. Over here. So even in the z direction, we have a very narrow width if we like it. Okay? In fact, in the velocity directions coming out of the interferometer, this would be much narrower. This is a pretty precise way of choosing neutrons. Then we add 5 blades and 9 blades, and you can see that the structure of the monochromator is exactly mapped into this process, so that we can map, we can point to every blade in the monochromator. And the reason it looked like a sinc function, of course, is it looks roughly square, right? But there's, you know, the features on top really are there and important. Okay. Now, let me go back to the other plot. If I go and let's look at this data set here. So here we have 9 blades, and we're going out to almost a tenth of a micron in the separation of the beams. We see that the contrast has roughly vanished. Okay, maybe there's some wiggles there, but no one would want to give much weight to those wiggles. Now you looked at, I don't know if you did. You were going to look at, in your homework, doing modifying the experiment to return the contrast in the case of the magnetic separation of the two beams. Did they do that?
No, I haven't. That's fun. I worked on yesterday and also will be done today.
Okay. All right. So now, based upon that result that you don't have, let's think about the experiment here. Okay. So now I have the neutron interferometer. I've put my prisms here. I have a phase flag. And I want to describe what happens, what the wave function is of the neutrons coming out of the interferometer. Okay? And so what we end up with here, now, if I had the interferometer within the contrast length, within the coherence length, so if I take delta z here, and I say that delta z is much, much less than the coherence length, which is equal to 1 over the spread in momentum along the z direction, okay? And I should put a factor of 2 pi there, but forgive me, my factors are 2 pi. So we have this discoherence. And if we said, okay, so it's much, much less than that, right? Then how would we describe the neutron beam coming out of the interferometer? We say that we have a wave function that is, now I need to have a new parameter, right? I need to have a parameter that tells me that the neutron beam is shifted, okay? So, we'll say that we have 0 and 1 are the paths. Let's leave them as they were before. The sine of ky. And now let's use 0 and plus as the value of delta z. Okay? And we go through our neutron interferometer. Here, the input state is 0 and 0. Okay, it's in the zero of the momentum, and it's not shifted. And here, we have a basis at 0, 1. Here we have our prisms, and so at this point, it goes to 1, and 0, and 0, 0 to 1 and plus, yeah? We pick up a phase shift here. So our phase, remember that we flipped the blades there. Maybe this is all too fast for you, so let me try to make sure that we understand each other. Psi 0. Allow it to undergo this shift. We have the mirror. It's not so interesting, but we might as well put it in. The phase flag, I'll just put the phase flag up here. So that's this one. And I need to add a phase here, sorry about that, e to the I kz delta z. And finally, we could look at what happens out of the beam, out of the interferometer after the third blade. So we have another effective Hadamard that looks like e to the I phi. So, if by some miracle I didn't make any mistakes, Then we can ask, well, what happens at each of the two paths?
So we have our interferometer in the O beam in the H beam.
And the O beam, of course, is the zero state. So we say, oh, well, okay.
Psi in the O beam
is going to have this term, right? There.
What's that?
Is there a B field?
No. Everything's just with what we've written up. And we get this nice piece here. And, of course, there's a factor of two that comes along, right? Because I'm only looking at one output. Okay? And since I'm only looking at one output, there's no reason to carry along the index of telling me which output I'm looking at. I've already got that index right here. So I can just drop this index. I'll put it off. So we have E to the I KZ delta Z plus minus E to the I phi 0 tensor 0, which is just the path, and we can drop that. So we end up
with a coherent superposition of the neutron with the same momentum taking two different heights in its path out of the interferometer. Okay? So our beam coming out of the interferometer, well, this is 8 millimeters high. But each neutron in that beam coming out of the interferometer is in a coherent superposition of being undisplaced and displaced by a small amount. That's amount being up to 0.1 microns in the experiment that we've shown. Okay? Now notice what happens here. That my computer turns off. We've defined this wave function for the neutrons coming out of the interferometer. Of course, because there's some variation in KZ, that when we integrate over that variation, we may find that there's actually no coherence in the system, right? So it could be that as we integrated over this, that we would have just a beam with neutrons in this path or this path, right? Randomly taking one of those. But KZ is really given by, it's not the property of an individual neutron. Right? It's just a property of the crystals that we placed in front of the interferometer. Right? So that distribution has nothing to do with any individual neutron. So this contrast, although if we looked at that beam, we might not be able to tell, that contrast is never fundamentally lost. We should always be able to recover it. So how could we recover the contrast? So in order to recover the contrast, the reason we lost the contrast was that we have a spread in KZ. So if I want to recover the contrast, what we need to do is to select out a value of KZ that is sharper than the distribution that we had above. So in other words, if I go back, here, you know, it really looks like we should be able to select out some value of kz, right? That this doesn't look like a featureless distribution. So we say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just take some little piece of kz. And even though the information is out of the interferometer at this point, we say, oh, we started off with this. We ran through the interferometer with this broad distribution. After the interferometer, I'm going to select out only a narrow distribution of kz, and we will go from this piece to this piece. We'll be able to restore contrast to that fraction of the distribution of momentum that we actually look at. Okay? So I need a bigger board. So now then we take, okay, our interferometer. We come in with the neutron beam. It takes two paths. In one of the paths, we shift it with the prisms. We combine those two here. And coming out of it, we have a coherent superposition of these two. Okay. And, you know, basically you could say, ah, well, what does it look like? It says that there's a wave packet, you know, in this direction, along the z direction, right? And so I can spread these things out. Horrible pictures. And you can say, ah, well, if they overlap, we get contrast. They don't overlap. We don't get contrast. We're out here. And then if I want to select out the z component, then I can't select out the z component with this arrangement of an interferometer, right? Because the blades are arranged so that they're insensitive to the z momentum. So I need to put another crystal here. That recombines those two and removes that separation. And now if I look out here with my helium-3 detector, I look out here, I'll see that I restore contrast. Okay. Now, there's two ways you can think about this. So this is a separation really in real space. Okay, I've really displaced the two neutron beams, so they're in a coherent superposition of moving like this. And because there's a distribution of momentum, each of them is a wave packet moving in that direction. And if I detected with the wave packets being separated, there could be no interference if I've separated the beams outside of the spatial extent of the wave packet. Okay. And so I can think about this crystal in two what sound different but equivalent ways. One, I could say, well, I've used the crystal to select a narrower distribution of momentum, in which case I've taken the width of the wave packets and I've made them bigger, and now I've forced them to overlap. Okay. Alternatively, we could analyze it and say, ah, I've used the Bragg condition to put those two beams back together, and so that they're shifted. And now I get a contrast between them, even though the wave packets remain small. And if you look at those, if you analyze it in both of those ways, you get exactly the same result. Okay, but here we've done a post-selection experiment. Write that down. And I like it to say that we've post-selected on the momentum. But at other times in my papers, I might say that we've recombined the beams to try to show some other piece of physics. But we've post-selected on the momentum. And now the wave packets overlap and we see a contrast. Okay. Let me not bother to go through and show you that data. It doesn't add anything. You've already seen all these things. Now, what happens? So here we have our two prisms. They shifted the beam. What happens if, again, very similar to what we've done in the past, I put two prisms here, and I shift this beam up? So we came in this place, and we shifted one of them, and let's say we shift it high enough that we're outside of the coherence length, and so that now when they arrive at the third blade, it looks like two independent events because they're outside of the coherence length, and the neutrons would apparently randomly go in different directions, right? Be careful about that because we can post-select and recover it, yeah? Okay, and now I say, well, okay, I'm free to put another set of prisms here, and I can take this path and I can place it up there at the same displacement as the other path. And I'm hoping somebody will say to me that we should recover the contrast, because now we've placed the two beams exactly in an area where the interference, where they're both within the wave packet of each other, yeah. And you can, let me just tell you to look at the notes. It's in the notes. I show you that. It'll save me turning on the projector one more time. So if you look at the notes, we do that experiment, and it works perfectly. That's is as clean and beautiful an experiment as you will ever want to see. Okay. Now, over here, we've got this wave. And if you'll remember from your introductory quantum mechanics courses, that the wave packet we always consider is that of a Gaussian. Because, you know, after 150 years of physics, we've learned how to integrate to Gaussian, and not much else. So we take and say that, yes, we've got a Gaussian distribution of momentum. We can define a wave packet. We have one nice little parameter, that nice little parameter being simply the width of the Gaussian, right? And we can show that if we look at the wave packet has a Gaussian response, a Gaussian envelope, because the Fourier transform of Gaussian is a Gaussian, and it's all related. Life is so simple. So if I take and look at a Gaussian wave packet, then it's easy to describe the motion of the wave packet through space. So what would we see if I plotted out
the wave packet coming out. So now we don't shift the yellow line. What do I see for the wave packet in this case? You must have seen wave packets. Yeah. Let me try to get some response from you guys. I have a displacement, Z. I'm going to put a magnetic field here, B naught. I'll take an electron, and I'll move it through the magnetic field. The electron, of course, has spin, and so there's two different potentials that the electron sees. The electron sees a potential from the magnetic field for spin up and spin down. We scatter off a barrier. I make the barrier of approximately the height of that potential. Okay. I'm hoping that all of you did this calculation in your sophomore year. Wasn't that long ago? Was this century? I can't say that. And I have coming into this some wave packet. What do I see at this barrier? I see what? I do. And what does it look like? So let's just say I had one spin. I just have one wave packet coming in. What would the wave packet look like as it went through that? So now I would have coming in time, of course, the wave packet is moving closer and closer and closer, and at some point the front end of it hits this barrier. Some piece of the front end might go through it, some piece of it's going to be reflected. That reflected piece is going to interfere with the rest of the wave packet, which is there, right? And so we're going to see a series of interference fringes. Yeah? Okay. If this is new to you, go ahead and do it as part of the tutorial, right? Write up a little, I've given you all these mathematical files. You give me a mathematical file. Show me that you can observe in a simulation the interference fringes that you would see for that. Okay? Immediate gratification. Looks nice visually. You'll show me that when you were a sophomore, you had all of this in physics. So here, we've done the same thing. We've taken the wave packet. I go to a lot of grief of calculating the Wigner function first, but forget the Wigner function. You don't need it. This is just a wave packet coming out of the interferometer. And so what we have here is just a plot of effectively the intensity. Here I've got the z-axis, and here we have time. And what you see is that as we increase the separation, and it looks, let me make sure that I've described this correctly to you. Here I've got the z-axis. Here I have the separation that we have the two neutron beams coming out of the interferometer at. And as they get more and more separated, we see nothing interesting. There's no interference effects. But as they're within the coherence length, then we see these interference fringes. And they're a little bit of a drag to see nicely just because
the variation of momentum I chose leads to sharp interference fringes. But you can see the interference fringes here. They extend here. It's just the visualization doesn't extend because it's at too high a resolution. But all through here, you see that you have nice interference fringes. And after some point, when you move out of the coherence lines, remember that these are Gaussians. So there's, you know, there's residues of an interference fringe here just because the Gaussians have tails and they're still overlapping a little bit, yeah? But as we move out, then we apparently lose the interference fringes. And then even though I'm out here, I can select a piece of the momentum that will return those interference fringes. Now, when Ben was teaching, did he talk about Wigner functions?
No, Wigner function was mentioned in quantum foundations.
Oh, good.
But not very deeply. So.
That's okay. So a Wigner function is a quasi-probability function, okay? And if it's, you know, it's as though you're looking in phase space at a wave function. So imagine that you have momentum in a real space coordinate. The nice thing about a Wigner function is in order to understand the outcome, you're going to integrate over this quasi-probability function. So if I look at the Wigner function of this, and I give you the notebook which plots the Wigner function, so you can look at it, you'll find that even in the case where these are fully separated, there are interference fringes in the Wigner function. When you integrate over the width of the probability, those fringes will integrate to zero. But they're always there, regardless of how separated the two beams are. In the Wigner function, the quasi-probability function, the interference fringes are always there, because the quasi-probability function is built up from a set of delta functions of the momentum. Right? So it's always there. And it's the integration over the probability distribution that you actually have that suppresses those. So that's why the Wigner function is a bit of a nicer way of looking at this information. Right? Because here, when I plot out, of course, what happens with the wave packet picture, I've already chosen, locked in one particular momentum distribution. Of course, we could have said, oh, well, let's make the Gaussian much broader, and then the interference fringes would extend further. Okay? Okay, so look, yeah.
So the Wigner function is like a probability distribution over the entire phase space.
Right? Over the,
and
right.
The margins of that are the distributions over position and moment.
That's correct. So I do give it to you. You can have a look in a separate Mathematica notebook on that. Here's this. What we're going to do tomorrow, Monday, you can do what you like. On Monday, what we're going to do is to go over and put spin explicitly into the neutron interferometer. So I'm going to forget about all this wave stuff in the neutron interferometer, go back and look at manipulating spin so that we can create an entangled state. And the piece that I'm leading to is after Monday's lecture, I want you to take the model which we had worked out over here last class and apply that to a Bell state generated in the neutron interferometer and tell me what you can learn from that. Okay? So that's where we're going.
Just a couple of announcements. From next week, the first lecture will be held in the Lee building. And I'll send out an email with the details. And also, sometime in the next couple of hours, I'll post some work. So that you don't have to rush after your breakfast all the way over here.
Okay, so I was assuming that was a positive thing for people. So we don't have to move. So if it isn't a plus, then work it out and tell me where I should be.